Rolling.
Well, welcome to another episode from Panoramic Outdoors. Doing a podcast today from beautiful Winnipeg, Manitoba. We've got three guys behind the mic today, a little bit different. I got myself, Sheldon Grant.
Chase Dralick here.
And we got a guest today who's filling in for Tristan, Frank Baldwin. One quick introduction to tell the boys, boys and girls, where you come from, who you are, what you do.
Sure. Born and raised in Manitoba, and I'm the provincial gamer manager for Manitoba Sustainable Development, which is a provincial government department. And yeah, looking forward to talk to you guys about waterfowl and other game birds.
Yeah, we got a couple interesting topics to talk about today. A couple big things on the horizon coming up for you guys. Before we get into that, though, why don't you give us a little background of your history and how you relate to conservation and whether or not you're a hunter and what you're into.
Sure. Well, As I said, I grew up here in Manitoba, close to Okamak Marsh, which is a major staging area for subarctic nesting Canada geese and a lot of prairie nesting ducks and other Arctic geese also. And I am a waterfowl hunter. That's definitely my number one pursuit.
So let me stop you there for a second. Do you strictly hunt waterfowl and game birds, or do you slide out and do a little bit of big game hunting also?
No, I love big game hunting. I'm an archery hunter. Right after waterfowl season, I'm an archery hunter. I love chasing whitetails, elk, and black bears also. So as soon as the freeze up comes, I'm in a deer stand basically for the next month. So.
Awesome. But first and foremost is waterfowl for you.
That's my kind of first, yeah. I mean, waterfowl hunting's the most important sort of outdoor pursuit for me.
Right.
The birds and the marsh and the dogs, you know, yeah, that's what does it for me. Decoys.
Yeah.
Duck boats.
Yeah. I know anyone that's ever hunted over a dog definitely finds a new kind of joy or new interest in hunting waterfowl. I don't know if I know we grew up, we didn't have a dog, but I think around 14, 15, we got one, and it was a game changer for the waterfowl for us. And anyone that hasn't done it or hasn't hunted over a dog definitely has to try it.
Yeah, it's one of those 50-50 things though. When everybody's like, oh, can I bring out my new dog? And you're like, oh, man, really? He's busting out of blind every time.
Yeah.
But no, it is super fun to hunt over a dog and just to see them work. It's a whole new experience for sure.
And going from having, I had my old black lab, he was 11, and I went after I put him down, he got old, and I went for a season without hunting a dog, and that's a real eye-opener. Going from having a well-trained dog to not, and then, so I had a year break there, and I've got a 2.5-year-old black female lab now. So
one thing I found interesting when we had our dog was the how he evolved throughout his life, and how, I mean, he was always a great retriever, never the best listener, we'll say. So he often broke and stuff like that, which was, I mean, sometimes fine, but sometimes it was a little critical for him not to break when birds were coming in. But he loved the dirty work, man, and that's fine with me.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was interesting to see that towards the end of his bird hunting career how he kind of realized, okay, these guys missed the entire flock. I don't have to go out here every time jumping out of the boat and stuff. So
it's
neat.
Yeah, it's for my favorite waterfowl to pursue are diving ducks, like big water divers too. So a dog is such a necessary part of that game. You know, they're chasing like wounded birds and often in heavy waves and, you know, snow and ice. And so, yeah, it's a short season and basically 10 months off before spring snow geese get going. But the dog is a big part of it for me.
Yeah, those divers are sometimes in some pretty deep spots too, where chest waders or even a little struggle to grab a duck.
Yeah, tough birds.
So when you're talking about divers, like for instance in Manitoba, for anyone that's listening that doesn't know much about waterfowl or wants to get into it, a diver in Manitoba, what's your most majority bird, like the most common around here?
Ringnecks and lesser scaup, or people also call them bluebills, and canvasbacks, redheads.
Oh, yeah.
Like things like buffleheads and other, you know, things like golden eye also, but canvasbacks and redheads, those are the ones I like to chase, and those are kind of what's famous in Manitoba too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your biology background?
Sure. So from a young age, I grew up with a father that was a research scientist. He was actually a pathologist, so he was a medical researcher. But his true love was waterfowl hunting and waterfowl. So he really instilled a passion in me for not only waterfowl hunting, but waterfowl conservation. And he really did a good job explaining to me the sort of the importance of hunters and how hunters fit into conservation. And I've never really wanted to do anything else other than be a waterfowl biologist ever since I was a really small kid. You know, my science fair projects when I was in elementary school were about marshes, waterfowl. So that's what I've always wanted to do. And I basically have, you know, what people call their dream job. I do almost all of it for free except the office work.
That's definitely passion right there.
Yeah, exactly.
You described that. That's cool. So how long have you been, we'll say like a certified waterfowl biologist?
I started out, I did an undergraduate degree here at the University of Winnipeg. And so that was a 4-year degree, and I did an honors thesis looking at the effectiveness of spinning wing decoys. So rotary wing decoys, mojo mallards, lucky ducks, like the trade names. And
that sounds like a pretty sweet project to be
on. That was a fun project. Yeah. We basically took people hunting, and our control was no spinning wing decoy over a spread of mallard decoys in the marsh. And then our experimental part was turning on spinning wing decoy and looking at difference in kill rate and crippling loss and species composition in the kill. And so that was pretty, that was kind of my first research project when I was an undergrad student. And
so how old were you when you were doing that?
I was 21. Yeah.
So, and how old are you now?
I'm 36 now. So after I finished that, I went and I did a master's degree at University of Saskatchewan, and I worked on Arctic nesting geese in Nunavut. So I worked on a colony of Ross's geese, which are similar to snow geese, a little bit smaller, bit different nesting distribution, but they nest in these really, really dense colonies. And so got kind of a flavor for the north and worked in really remote places. And from there, I went, after I finished that in Saskatchewan, I was a 2-year degree, and I went to Alberta, and I worked for Canadian Wildlife Service in Alberta about 2.5 years. And then I got my current job in 2008, and I've been there ever since.
Good.
Sweet. Just to back it up here first, so like RoboDucks and stuff, you do this thesis and you go out hunting. They obviously work.
Yeah.
I've used them.
Yeah.
They're pretty wicked things, eh?
They're unbelievable, especially in fields. The kill rate in fields is much, much higher than in the marsh.
Right? Really? Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
So like, do you have any kind of numbers you can toss around on that, or is there?
It's been a while ago, and there's a friend of mine that I was doing the work in the marsh, and he was doing the work in the grain fields, and just off the top of my head, I think the kill rate in the fields was in the high, so it was, I think they were about 28 times more effective than not having a spinning wing decoy, and in the marsh, I think it's on mallards. And I think it was maybe 3 to 4 times more in the marsh. So it's still pretty effective. So quite a bit more effective. But the fields, I mean, we all know there's probably a lot of people listening that have never hunted ducks in a field without a spinning wing decoy.
Right.
And it's an eye opener. Yeah. They just do not commit the way that they do with the
spinning. Oh, exactly. So when you did that, doing those projects and stuff, did you ever like Did you have to like take number on if Canada geese come to them, if any other species comes to those spinning wing decoys, or is it just a mallard kind of?
We just were looking at ducks, and for our sample size, we really only had enough to look at ducks and really mallards. Mallards were the big question. So we didn't look at geese mainly just because of sample size issues. We were picking fields with ducks and hunting, picking spots in the marsh with ducks. But as you probably know, like geese flare at about 80, 90 yards.
Yeah.
We
hunt them quite a bit around Neepawa there, and every field you go to, it's a mixed breed. There's Canadas, there's ducks, everything. And we spend more time yelling at the guy with the remote controller, shut it off, than it is, looking at birds. But yeah, we find that like where we hunt, that we often have to shut them off when the Canadas are coming in and turning it on first thing in the morning when it's good to shoot and wait for those ducks, and they seem to come in and you don't even see them until they're there. So it works.
Yeah.
Man, I love that stuff.
It's amazing how they respond to it. Even to the point that you really can use them in a field with literally no other decoys.
Right.
Just a spinning wing decoy, and you'll shoot ducks over it. And yeah, so when these things first were coming out, it was a big question about, what do the kill rates look like with these? And, we don't have any restrictions on them in Manitoba, as you both know, but in a lot of jurisdictions they do.
Oh, really?
A lot of places they have restrictions on what part of the season you can use them in. They also have restrictions on whether you can use them on public land. So a lot of places have bans on public land.
Huh.
And some states ban them outright. There's
really?
A few states that there's no electronic decoys allowed whatsoever.
Huh. Yeah.
So there's kind of a mixed master of regs, but I know some of the places that have, public bans on them, it's because not everybody wants to hunt with them, but in areas where you have, multiple groups of hunters, competing with someone that has a spinning wing decoy is just not possible.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the other guys might as well just go home.
Yeah.
Or
sure.
Join them up for an extra couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. Right on.
So I guess we can kind of start off with the big topic that we wanted to discuss with you today is this new talk about spring goose season for Canada's. We've seen in the Manitoba Wildlife Federation, I believe, had the survey put out, and it sounds like conservation is going ahead with the spring season. Is that correct?
We're just working on, right now, just to back up a little bit about spring season. So in the Migratory Bird Treaty that was signed over 100 years ago, that set about the maximum number of days that you can hunt migratory birds for in the countries, and the dates in which those 107 days can occur. So that treaty laid out that you can only hunt for 107 days, migratory birds, and they must fall between September 1 and March 10th. And anything outside of that in Canada, in order to be able to hunt during that spring period outside of March 10th, they have to be designated as overabundant. And so
okay.
That was the situation with snow geese.
Right.
Back in the late 90s where they got designated as overabundant because there's damage occurring to Arctic habitat.
Right.
So the case, what we have, or the situation that we have now for Canada geese is that we actually have proposed a March 1st to 10th season. So that falls within our normal hunting framework. But given the really early springs that we've had in Manitoba the last few years, with the exception of this year.
Yeah, this year wouldn't have been that great, I don't think.
We had some extra days available. So we've got a season for March 10th. March 1st to 10th proposed for 2019. And then we're also have filed a notice of intent with Canadian Wildlife Service that temperate nesting Canada geese, or giant Canada geese, the ones that nest in southern Manitoba here, be designated as overabundant.
Okay.
And so we've provided a list of sort of rationale on why we think that should be so. And then that will be reviewed. And if that decision is made to list them as overabundant, then that would allow for spring conservation seasons after March 10th.
So just to get into the it was 107 days you said it was for waterfowl?
Yes.
Is that species specific, or is that right from waterfowl season, or was it waterfowl or migratory game bird?
Yeah, it's migratory game bird. So waterfowl. So you can't have a season longer than 107 days or outside of that March 10th period or earlier than September 1st, unless you designated that species or population as something that was overabundant.
Okay. So what is the fall waterfowl season? How many days long is that one generally?
It is, so right now it's September 1st till November 30th is the longest we have. And then we've just, at the same time as proposing that March 1 to 10 season, we've also like to see that fall season an extra week. So that will go in 2019, it will go September 1st till December 6th.
Okay.
And then we'll have a March 1st to 10th season in the spring for Canada geese. And that will take care of all of our 107 days. We'll be maxed out.
So it's in the past, it's been about 90 days, maybe about 91 days.
Yeah.
And then this fall is going to be about 96, 97, something like that.
And then the rest of the other 10 will be in
March. In the spring, to the 10th.
Right.
Which was
that's right.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
So that really exhausts our all the days that we have. And then this notice of intent to declare giant Canada geese as overabundant, that if that is successfully supported, by the federal government, which we feel strongly that it should be, that would allow for seasons to occur March 11th to, you know, say the end of March. And the exact timing of that season will depend on the timing of migration of different populations of Canada geese, because we want to try and avoid harvesting other populations that might be mixed in during the spring migration with the temperate nesters or the giant Canada geese that nest in southern Manitoba here.
So how many different, say, species of Canada geese are there in Manitoba? Because, I mean, you talk to people and they often hear the terms, you know, giant Canada, Canada geese, cacklers.
Yeah, and lessers,
the lessers, yeah. So there's it's probably most of it, lots of it slang going around. There's probably some other names that maybe we haven't heard about. But from a scientific point of view, how many species are you guys dealing with?
I think waterfowl biologists have done a really good job confusing people with all the different populations, species, subspecies. I'll tell you the three populations that move through Manitoba. And recently, or back in 2004, not that recently, the group called American Ornithologists Union split off Canada geese and cackling geese. And cackling geese are the ones that are the small, really small-bodied birds. They have very short little bills. Some of them are not much bigger than a mallard, and they nest in the far north, Baffin Island, Southampton Island. So those ones we call cackling geese. They're Branta hutchinsi is their scientific name. And then we have Canada geese, Branta canadensis. And those ones, there's two populations. So there's the giant Canada geese, we call them the temperate nesting population now. They nest all over southern Manitoba, mostly in the agriculture areas. Some of them do nest in the boreal also. And then obviously they'll nest all over the northern U.S., and so we have not only the birds that are produced here, but we have all the molt migrants that come up from the U.S. that are either too young to breed or have failed nests. And they come up during the summertime, molt in various parts of Manitoba, and then they return back to their natal areas in September. So that's one population. And then we have subarctic nesting Canadas, which nest in the Hudson Bay lowlands of northern Manitoba. Southern Hudson Bay population, we call them. And those are the birds that primarily come through the Interlake region, stage at Okamak. And they're a population that Manitoba shoots a large proportion of in the flyway. They're very important to our harvest. We shoot about half of what's killed in the entire flyway.
Oh, really?
And then we have the cackling geese. And they nest sort of throughout the Arctic, but most of the ones that come through Manitoba come from southwest Baffin Island. So,
interesting.
Yeah, Baffin Cagliers, the subarctic Canadas, and then the giant Canadas.
So those things are making quite the trek.
Yeah, they make an unbelievable.
Size-wise for the giants, what kind of weights are we talking?
On adult birds during the fall, sort of anything over 10 pounds. The subarctic birds are sort of more around like 6 to 8. So they're kind of medium sized, and then the cappers are quite small, so under 4 pounds.
Do you ever find those subspecies kind of crossing over in their say nesting grounds? Like, do you ever find a giant Canada up in the bay or way up north, Baffin Island?
Great question. There's what we call hybrid zones, where they sort of grade into each other, but not so much with the giants because they occur at very low densities in the boreal, and then they sort of become smaller as you move further north. So the ones that nest on the Hudson Bay lowlands are actually genetically indistinguishable from the ones that nest in southern Manitoba here, but they're a lot smaller, probably just because of some kind of environmental constraint.
Right.
You need to be small to be in that sort of poor habitat and get your goslings off to migrate.
Yeah, the giants definitely have a better food source down here,
I think. And then you see those subarctic Canadas and the cacklers. There's different areas where they hybridize. So you see pairs where there's a real small individual and then a much larger individual. And there's parts of sort of right along the Manitoba Nunavut border is a real hybrid zone, and then they kind of grade entirely into cacklers. Yeah.
So when you're talking about like the dark geese or that proposed new season, for everyday Joe, what kind of do they get to like harvest all three of those species you just talked about, or is there more than that? Or
great question. Because we don't think that hunters can distinguish them because they're on the wing, especially when we know they can't distinguish them.
Right.
We're going to time the seasons such that all the harvest is on the giant Canadas. So
okay.
We have a study right now where we have tracking devices on each population, and we're looking at sort of the chronology of spring migration among those three populations and figuring out when they're separated and for how long. So we have these little units called geolocator devices on plastic leg bands on the birds, and they log light levels, and they have a little timer on there and a little hard drive, and they're constantly logging light intensity. And so we can use the duration of daylight and then the estimated time of high noon to figure out latitude and longitude from those. So we have to recapture them to get the data from them. And then we can analyze that data and look at how those three populations move in the springtime. And
right.
What we've seen, so we have 2 years, we'll have 2 years of spring migration data after this coming year. So we'll recapture a whole bunch of birds during banding, get the data from their geolocator devices, analyze it. And by the time we have to propose the season dates for any conservation season, we'll have all that information to try and time the season so that all the harvest is on those giant Canadas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Then one more question for you, too, so you're talking about that 107-day treaty, which I can't remember what dates you were saying. So that was something they came up with 100 years ago or whatever?
Yes.
Do you ever think that those days may change because of like flight patterns and the times that they're actually flying? Like, I has that changed? Like, I mean, what are we sitting under, the central fly zone or something like that?
Yeah, well, I think we're in the Mississippi Flyway, but I think I understand what you're saying. Like the September 1st to March 10th, like somebody said that, you know,
right,
over 100 years ago, and we knew far less about migratory birds than we do now. And so why are we, I think you're sort of getting that, why are
yeah,
we sort
exactly.
of holding ourselves to those dates?
Yeah.
That's a fantastic question. And that's what there's people talking about, that same issue, that maybe that treaty needs to sort of evolve with our understanding of these populations and whether that treaty should limit our ability to try and manage some of these populations. And that's sort of the crux of this issue, is that the reason we're doing all this research is because we're really concerned about the growth of the giant Canada goose population. So really high sustained growth rates. Off the top of my head, I think 11% per year they're growing, so doubling every six years or so.
Wow.
And not from the different experiments we've done with bag limits and increasing our bag limits from 5 to 8 to 12 in some areas, very little effective harvest. We don't really have the ability to try to control that population through fall harvest in Manitoba because the swamping effect from all these other populations, we think. So it makes it very hard to control this giant Canada goose population. And that's, that's the rationale for trying to bring in some spring harvest, is that at that time, if we can get after them when they're most segregated from other populations, we could put all the harvest pressure on this one population that's growing like gangbusters and maybe bring it under control. But your question about the treaty is a great one, and there's a lot of discussion about the limitations for kind of contemporary management.
So it seems like the flyways have changed a little bit from, I mean, I'm not a specialist on it at all, but just kind of hearsay is that you often hear that, snow geese used to be coming down here and now they're not, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so that, I'm sure, like that has to maybe affect the decisions of possibly changing up the treaty a little bit and maybe certain areas. And like, does global warming or climate change, we'll say, have a bit of effect on that? Or
I think the distribution of birds is not so much an issue with the treaty. The treaty really is just for setting out timing of harvest that they thought at the time would be sustainable and fair. And so there was some ethical reasons that the treaty, that those dates were set up the way they are. So to trying to avoid, harvest hunting during the nesting season, those sorts of things. I think the change in the migration of birds that we've seen, at least in some populations, those are real. People talk about especially the changes in snow geese and the westward shift in snow geese. And at one time, virtually the entire mid-continent population used to come through Manitoba. They used to go through Manitoba in the spring on their way up to the breeding grounds, and that's changed a lot. I mean, we have relatively small proportion of that population now. They're mostly in Saskatchewan and even eastern Alberta now. And some of that's probably related to how some of the different colonies in the Arctic have waxed and waned with changes in their habitat. It also could be related to food supply in those staging areas in the spring. So as snow geese have damaged some of their habitat in the subarctic, there's not the same food supply that they need to replenish their reserves when they get to those areas. So there's probably a few things going on there.
So you say they damage their habitat. Like snow geese, they root up plants compared to Canada's that just nip the tops off or something like that. Is that true?
In the springtime, So snow geese, they pull shoots up, and they're pretty good at accessing roots in sort of soft ground in those subarctic areas. And the reason they're doing that is because that's where the nutrition is. Those plants haven't sent those starches up. They've remained in the root, so they're accessing the most nutritious part of the root.
Right.
I mean, Canada's also do a little bit of shoot pulling, and they they're predominantly grazers, but they do some shoot pulling in the spring also.
Right.
Snow geese, the issue with snow geese, especially in northern Manitoba, is that there's a huge population that goes through a relatively small part of the coastline. So they really bottleneck in that Hudson Bay coast. And where most of their food supply is within a mile or a few miles of the coast. And you have a massive population going through that one little area because there's, accessible food there in the springtime. It melts there early.
Right.
And then they sort of span out from there and they go to different colonies. So they do, there's pretty well understood that they've caused a fair bit of damage in coastal parts of Manitoba, especially in salt marshes. But we're learning that... they in other areas they're utilizing more freshwater habitat, and there they haven't caused the same state of damage. So it's not the scale of damage that they've caused and how that's affected other species is still not very well understood, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then when you're doing these kind of studies with Manitoba, like you're when it comes to migratory, obviously it means they're flying from X to Y, which is a long distance. So do you guys generally work alongside with the United States and different states where they're stopped, like you have the majority of the geese stopping in at or whatever? Like you work with those other groups as well, or?
Yes, yeah. So it's called the flyway system, set up in about 1955, I think, where Canadian jurisdictions and U.S. jurisdictions, plus the two federal governments, started to meet to talk about migratory bird issues. And that continues through till today. We have two meetings a year, a winter meeting and a summer meeting. And we talk about harvest management plans, we draft plans, we go through all the data, we share costs. So a lot of the field work that we do in northern Manitoba is there's a major financial contribution from US states. And we use our band recovery data. So every year we band all these different populations, especially geese, and then we use the recoveries of those bands to sort of figure out which jurisdictions we meet with on management plans and kind of who pays for which portion of management. So it's become a fairly fine-tuned system of international cooperation.
Yeah, I guess like Canada's, especially northern Canada, is playing a big role in the waterfowl management side of things. So it definitely benefit everybody down south where the birds would just be kind of flying through to help fund the management of these birds up here, right?
Absolutely. And by the same token, so the habitat in northern Canada and on the prairies is really important to waterfowl, but by the same token, the wintering habitat in the southern U.S.
Yeah.
is crucial also. So,
yeah.
Yeah, if they don't have those they have a fantastic refuge system all through the U.S. as those birds are moving through, and yeah, it's a real cooperative approach.
That's the cool thing about hunters and conservationists, though, is that when they all get together, they kind of have the same goal in mind, right? So no matter where we're coming from, Canada, U.S., and I know I've done some reading, even I think Mexico says, looks like they signed up for the North American Waterfowl Management Plan.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, a number of years ago now. So it's nice to see that all three countries bit of separation they have all can come together to manage one kind of game management.
There's even treaties with Russia and Japan also.
Really?
US, yeah.
Wow.
Because there's populations that are shared with those.
Okay, I gotta ask you a question to make this a little bit lighter side. So I heard a story from a guy. Now you're gonna tell. I don't know if you'll be able to tell me if this is like believable or not because my information is a little weak. But he shot a bird in around 2005, 2006. It was a redhead, and it was banded in. He said 1994 in somewhere in China. Would that be believable at all? Like that's 10 years old. That redhead.
The age is believable.
The age is believable.
Yep, the age is believable. The banded in China sounds a little
off,
far-fetched, but
okay.
I think there have been recoveries of pintails maybe, things like Eurasian widgeon maybe.
Okay.
But yeah.
Wasn't there some like Russian, I want to say stork, but some kind of like crane or some Russian crane or something up in Churchill? A couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, someone was telling me about that.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sure.
It was something.
Yeah, it was some sort of crane. It was something very unique. So I guess.
Yeah, I'm not too sure.
Could happen. I don't know if it would be.
They do. I mean, they do.
Is there a redhead population in Japan?
In China.
I can't remember. Asian somewhere in there. Yeah,
well, I mean, like. There's pochards all through Europe, and I'm not sure actually about China, but yeah, we could check it out.
Yeah,
we could update you for your next podcast.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because I heard that story years ago, and then ever since then, I kind of always tell that story as like one of those myth stories. Like you want to tell it just to be if people call you out on it or not. Because I don't really know how true it is. And if the guy that told me, I don't know how legit he is. I just know he's an avid waterfowler. So
the distances that birds are capable of traveling is sometimes unbelievable. If you and true. I mean, yeah. Look at things like Arctic terns that go all the way from the Canadian Arctic to the Antarctic and back in 1 year, and they do that, and those things have really long, they're really long lived. I mean, some of them live for more than a decade, so they're logging like huge miles over the course of their lifetime.
Big time.
They probably have more miles on their belt than a helicopter pilot.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, that's great.
That's a lot of miles. Just to slide back to the dark geese topic for a second, in the spring, are you guys planning the same kind of limits on them, or have you figured that out yet?
We haven't figured that out. I think once we have a little more discussions with Canadian Wildlife Service on that overabundance designation, and we've got a bit better idea what our dates look like based on all those tracking devices, so how long your season might be based on what the separation is with those other populations, I think at that point we'll start to do a little bit more work on modeling what the kill could be. So we'll do a bit of work looking at what our hunter uptake might be. So what sort of numbers of hunters we might actually have pursuing those birds over that span of that season. So it'd be a fairly short season, you know, 2 to 3 weeks really of opportunity. And then from there, we'll do a bit of tinkering and modeling and try to figure out what we think the bag limit should be. But I don't think it will be a very large bag limit, I would suggest, to start. We're lucky that we'll have, well, not lucky, but by design, we'll have a lot of banded birds on the landscape by the time this rolls around. So 2021 will be the earliest that March 11th to whatever season, conservation season, opens, and by that time well we have a really nice banded sample now, but it'll be improved and we'll be able to look at the effect of that season using the banding data, so
right,
we'll sort of be able to fine-tune what we do to that population. We'll have a good idea of how the harvest affects
how many $100 bands are in that population.
We won't be putting reward bands on them.
And that's the other thing too, is like when it comes to a spring dark goose season, like even hunting a greater Canadian goose in the spring is a lot harder than it is going to be in the fall when they're, you know, they're not going to be in huge flocks and all that other stuff. So, I mean, your bag limits are probably going to be hard to attain in the first place.
Yeah, good point. I think I agree with that totally. And I think that the way that people will hunt them in March will also be a lot different. I don't think, for the most part, I don't think it will be spotting, you know, big groups of big fields and going and setting up. I think it'll be, you know, trafficking birds, like getting in areas where there's a good migration pathway, and on a day where you got a south wind and you're getting a big push of birds, just like we had 2 days ago and today, and getting in an area where they want to be, in places like, you know, marshes and where they're coming down to. Yeah. I think, you know, handful of decoys on the ice when you're ice fishing. I think it'll be that sort of thing. I don't think it'll be like the way that we hunt them in the fall.
There'll be some neat opportunities, that's for sure.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say or ask you too is like maybe just on a personal side here too is like, do you think that the spring Canada goose will be a better eating goose? Do you think there'll be like just a better all around, more fat kind of bird than there would be in the fall?
No, Manitoba? No question. Yeah. It'll be, I don't know if you've ever had spring snow geese. They are by far the best table fare. I think that they're the best wild game, period. I've had, you know, I shot a young bull elk this past fall. Delicious animal. A lot of people would say that's the creme de la creme of wild game.
Right.
I would, and my family will say the same thing. They would rather have a spring snow goose over a piece of elk. There's just no comparison. And I think spring Canada's will be the same. It's the food source they've been on. They would have been on, you know, corn and other cereals their entire migration, and they'll be really fat.
Yeah. For sure. I went on a spring snow goose hunt in Churchill a couple of years ago, and with a couple of the locals, and they kind of showed me different ways that, like, we made goose burger with like grinding up like the breast and the fat and like everything basically in it, grinding that up to like searing a goose breast on a frying pan, and yeah, it was unbelievable. It's probably one of my favorite for sure.
And it was very different from the fall.
Oh yeah. Like,
yeah.
I don't think I've ever had a spring bird.
No.
No, not yet.
They're well, it's funny when you go in the north, and a lot of the spring hunts in the Cree communities along the James Bay and Hudson Bay coast, they're a very important thing. People, you know, kids leave school for a week, 2 weeks, and they go and hunt, and
yeah.
And those communities don't really hunt in the fall. They
right.
They shoot everything they need in the springtime, and the reason is because the quality of the birds is so high. It's,
yeah, you often high. You often hear from lots of the northern folks that the spring birds are that much quality.
Yeah, better. when we went hunting there in Churchill, we took a bunch of birds to a couple of the elders in the community, and they're so happy to get them. And I was just like thinking, like, why are they so happy to get a goose? Like, so used to shooting goose or geese in the fall down southern Manitoba, where it's like, you know, you're trying to find new recipes to cook these things, not just frying them up. And these people out there are just loving life. But well, that was kind of funny.
Greasy chin, they call it.
Yeah.
The first greasy chin of the year. Yeah.
So talking bag limits, you said that in the spring might be a little bit less. I remember when you guys were starting to open up the fall goose bag limits. And I mean, we never hunted a lot of snow geese. Obviously, the opportunity was a lot less, and we were always big fall hunters. So when the fall goose, like dark geese, started opening up to 5 and then 8, and you know, we'd go out with 5 buddies in a good goose field, and you know, you shoot 45 geese. That sounds awesome. You have to clean them all, and it's,
yeah.
You know. Whatever, you shoot till noon, and then you got to buy 2 cases of beer to clean all the birds, and then it becomes an expensive affair. But
yeah.
Snow geese, there's no possession limit on them now, is that correct?
No possession. There's a bag limit of 50 in Manitoba.
So big question that's been kind of tossed around between us is, what do you do if you have no possession limit? And like, you and I were talking earlier, and you said you usually put about 100 in your freezer. What do you, how do you cook them? Like, you don't bake them every time, do you? Or what do you?
Oh, we do a variety of things. So we really try to, when I clean birds, I really try to take the skin with the muscle, with the breast. So I try to pluck the breast out and then singe it. And then take the fat and the skin off with the breast meat. And that is a game changer. That changes it from being just a goose breast to being like a piece of prime rib.
Yeah.
And then once we've done that, my favorite way is definitely on the barbecue, like on the grill.
Right.
I also like doing them in a Weber barbecue with like some wood chips for smoke.
Okay.
So, yeah, I have a smoker also, like a master chilled smoker, and I really like smoking birds, and
right.
Yeah, we do Asian kind of marinades and you name it, all sorts of things.
I think that's one of the things when it comes to like fall hunting and getting into waterfowl is like a lot of guys like to do it, but a lot of guys don't know how to prepare it or maybe experiment with it. And like over the years, talking with other hunters and stuff, like I found a few different ways that I enjoy, but I mean, it'd be nice to, you know a few different ways of doing it other than getting jerky or sausage. Like our family, we do a lot of sausage and we mix them with our deer meat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one way to, you know, if you don't want to say it, but if you need to get rid of some birds, you can throw it in with your deer meat or your moose meat, make some sausage. We do jerky. There's another one for any listeners out there. It's super simple. Is you take a crock pot, you take the whole chest cavity with the breast and the legs, throw it in the crock pot bone with the bone, some sauerkraut and a can of beer, and let it cook for, you know, 6 hours, 5 hours on low, and take it out and throw it on a bun. It's kind of like a pulled pork. Obviously, take the bones out, but yeah, it's kind of like that pulled pork kind of idea. And yeah, there's a bunch of different ways, but it's too bad there isn't like a big cookbook on how to cook wild waterfowl because...
Well, it's funny you should say that because... you obviously haven't seen the cookbook my dad wrote.
No, I haven't.
I'll have to bring you a copy. So before my dad passed away in 2011, he had mostly Well, he was 95%. He'd finished all the written part of this book, and he'd written a book about sort of different anecdotes of hunting waterfowl in Manitoba, and then a couple chapters on preparing waterfowl, so how to clean them properly, how to sort of maximize the use of them, and then a whole bunch of different ways to cook them, from sausage to different recipes for roasting and searing, and I'll have to. And then there's the part in there about sort of obscure things like snipe, and so yeah,
that'd be awesome.
I'll bring you a copy.
But is that something that's published now?
Yeah, I didn't finish my story. Yeah,
yeah.
He had finished the writing, and then he sort of died unexpectedly, and so we, my sister and my mom and I, decided that we would finish the book. And we worked with Ducks Unlimited Canada, and we turned the book into a fundraiser. So they did all the graphic design and layouts, and we published it. And a bunch of different places in the city sold it. We sold it online. And then we created a conservation fund from all the proceeds.
Oh,
and
nice.
It's being used to make a sort of a new display at the Okamak Marsh Interpretive Center.
Oh, awesome. Cool.
Yeah, that'll come out in the next year or so, I think. But I will make sure you get a copy.
So what's the title of that, just for anybody that's listening?
From the Marsh to the Table.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can still get it, obviously, in places, some places? Or?
If you go on Ducks Unlimited Canada's website, you can order it through their online store.
Oh, right.
Yeah. There's probably not a huge number of copies left, but I'll make sure you guys get one.
Awesome. Yeah. That'd be great.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's always tough sometimes to scrounge up new recipes and stuff like that, right?
So a few years ago, actually, when my old man, myself, and another couple of guys, we were huge into waterfowl hunting fields, layout blinds, so on and so forth, and we shot, had a good number of geese, and we decided to try just doing a straight goose sausage with some pork and whatever, and made that, and pretty much perfected it to the point where people actually still ask me if we make it. Like, that's how good it turned out. So, I mean, making goose sausage is always a go-to to making that kind of stuff. But
yeah, I always think what I normally do is I keep all my big honkers and I turn them into sausage and jerky. And I think one of the best skills for new hunters to learn and people that have been hunting for a long time is how to actually age waterfowl. So
yeah, and that's a good discussion in itself, right? Not to cut you off, but I'll just give you a quick how we do it, and you can tell me how you do it, and everyone else can learn. But a lot of times what we do, if a good mallard, for me, a nice fat mallard, you pluck it up, and what I do is I wrap it in paper towel, wet paper towel, and put it in the fridge for, you know, this is about a week before I even go to roast it. And that's generally how I was kind of taught, and that's what I do with a full bird after it's plucked to roast. But what do you like to do?
You're talking about hanging birds, and that's actually another part of it's another chapter in that book, but I totally agree. I hang my birds. I keep them, you know, before they're frozen. I like to keep them for about kind of 5 to 7 days also.
Right.
And not so much my ducks. I don't normally age my ducks so much as far as looking for whether they're like juvenile birds or adult birds. But my geese, I do to the extent possible. So if you look at the tail fan on geese and you look for notched tail feathers, you find any notched tail feathers, you know that it's a bird that was hatched that year.
Okay.
And those birds I keep aside, and I label them, and I'll use them for things, you know, like searing on the grill or stir fries, things like that. And then my adults, which on a giant Canada goose, average age is about 7 on an adult, so 7 years old. Those ones I keep aside, and I save them all for jerky and sausage, because there's a good chance they're going to be really, really tough. And
so what do you say to identify juveniles by what?
Using the notches on their tail fan. So the tail feathers.
So just like what do you mean by its notch?
You'll see if you sort of spread the tail fan out in your fingers and you looked at the very end of the tail feathers, on the juveniles you'll see a slight notch in it.
Okay.
And on an adult it'll be full right to a point.
Okay.
So they do late in the season it doesn't work as well for things that are hatched early in the year, like giant Canadas, but
right.
Up through, you know, first part of October it works really nicely.
Right.
And then you're guaranteed. And they're, you know, looking at other plumage also and other species. like snow geese, and
right.
then you're guaranteed that that bird's going to be really tender.
Yeah. And, like, that's what I've heard, and, like, I know my grandfather, I didn't really get to know him too well. He died when I was young. But talking to my uncles and stuff, they said that he used to take them ducks or whatever and hang them by, you know, their beak until their heads fell off. And I asked a few people, like, oh, is that with guts in or guts out? And people are like, oh, man, like, I don't really know. And but yes, and then some guys say, yeah, they just leave the guts in them. But is, like, do you guys do that kind of stuff?
Yeah, as long as the temperatures are, yeah, so guts in is as long as a few things. As long as the bird is not shot in the guts, so long as you don't have, you know, any sort of leakage there.
Right.
And also, depending on the species, diving ducks that are feeding on green vegetation, they can spoil faster. You have to sort of watch that they don't spoil. If you leave them guts in, their underbelly will go green.
Right.
But things like mallards, no, yeah, yeah. And divers, as long as they're not gut shot, and as long as the temperatures are right, you know, around like 3 to 4 degrees, yeah, I'll hang them guts in for definitely 5 to 7 days.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's definitely something I think a lot of people don't really do or don't really know about.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to kind of be set up for it too. So you have to be, you know, you got to have a screened in area where you don't have any flies in there, and then the temperatures have to be right. So
yeah.
anything
yeah.
I shoot early in the year in September, I pretty much process, you know, fairly soon, obviously.
Yeah. You could probably do it if you had a walk-in cooler. It'd be the same concept.
Oh, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it'd be almost like hanging a deer in a walk-in cooler as long,
yeah.
except you don't leave the guts in the deer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
cool.
For sure. Yeah, I guess that's it. I was going to ask something else, but I totally forgot what I was going to say.
I kind of want to go back for a second to, we were talking about using the harvest rate for controlling populations and stuff like that. And I think that was the main purpose behind the increase in the harvest rate for the snow geese, right? And so have you found in your studies and through other studies that has worked well for that population, or how is that
for snow geese?
Yeah.
No, it has not worked well for snow geese. So yeah, the harvest rate, that's proportion of the population that's you know, killed by hunters each year. So we can, using the banding data, we can look at the harvest rate for the juveniles or the harvest rate for the adults. And we typically will manage using the adult harvest rate. And so using population modeling, you can try to figure out at what sort of harvest rate you need with some assumptions to bring that population down to a given level. And for snow geese, the target harvest rate in the management plan is about 11%. And on adults, and the current harvest rate is about 2.5%, 3%.
Oh, wow. So that's way off.
It's very, very low. And it has been it really has remained unchanged for a long time. It's just, the issue is that population has grown so rapidly and continued to grow. And the number of hunters, just the harvest has not been able to keep pace with those increases. So.
Right. How many goslings in the average snow goose brood?
I think the average clutch size on them is around 4 or 5 in a normal year, sort of in an average year. But for snow geese, it's not how many, it's not, the clutch size doesn't really govern how fast their population grows. It's their survival rate. And so they're so long lived that they only really need to be successful once to replace themselves. So their snow geese have a survival rate. So the probability that they'll survive a calendar year of around 90%. And so, so that means, so, and there's, and so they, you know, the average age on them is, I think that makes the average age around like 10 to 12 years or so. So they really only need to have a good year every few years for that population to really rapidly grow.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize those birds live so long.
They're old. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not unusual to shoot birds in there. I've shot a few banded snow geese in 13, 14.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not
that's crazy.
Is there any way to tell the age of a bird, like, kind of generally, or no?
Not past age, not past when they go into their first year.
Okay.
Yeah, when they reach their second year, they're not possible unless you got them marked in some way.
Okay, fair enough.
Are the Canada geese, their clutch sizes, are they similar to snow geese also, or are they a little bit smaller usually?
A little bit bigger normally on the giant Canadas, and they don't go through the same, they are pretty much successful every year. So snow geese, their probability of nesting is influenced by climate and what sort of happens over the course of the spring and how good a condition they're in and what the Arctic fox population is like in the north, because they, you know, they cycle and
right.
all sorts of other things. You know, what kind of weather you have when the goslings are young, because the Arctic is a very, you know, obviously harsh place. So you get you can get freezing weather right when they're hatching, and that's lethal on goslings, or lots of rain. The birds down here, the giant Canadas, they're pretty much successful every year. So
they're just living in paradise.
Yeah, they live in paradise. Yeah, next to a golf course. And
yeah. I think I seen one nesting in one of the flower pots at Famous Dave's last year.
They love flower pots. Yeah. Flower pot balconies, you know, 6-7 floor balconies and flower pots. And yeah, they've got big clutches and really no uncertainty with nesting. Like, they're successful virtually every year unless somebody comes along and takes their eggs.
Right. So the kind of the conservation and tactic that I kind of know about for the snow geese is that you eventually want to, well, trying to get a handle on them before they eat themselves out of house and home and just kind of destroy all the habitat that they have to nest in. Correct? Is that kind of the
rationale for snow geese was to try and bring that population under control using all these additional harvest measures. And to date, that really hasn't been very successful. It doesn't necessarily mean that it won't become successful if there's other factors that come into play. So right now, we think that there's a little bit of what we call density dependence kicking in. So they're less successful than they used to be because of some of the issues they've maybe had on their habitat. So they're not capable of the same growth that they were, you know, a decade ago, 20 years ago, and that combined with some of that density dependence, harvest might play a bigger role. So the less recruitment that you have into the population, the more effect your harvest on those adults might be. And that's the rationale for Canada geese is the same, is that we want to try and use hunting to bring that population under control, not for the same environmental reasons as far as like the effect on habitat for Canada geese. It's really the growth rate being such a high growth rate that given the number of hunters that we have, we're worried about that they could just completely escape the control of hunting if we don't do something soon. And hunting is the primary mechanism of mortality. And right. they cause a tremendous amount of crop damage. So that's another issue. But last year, I think about compensation, about $450,000 in compensation, and about another $400,000 in vehicle collisions. And that's just the documented stuff. So that's just in Manitoba.
$400,000 in vehicle collisions?
Vehicle collisions, yeah.
With geese. Wow.
Yeah.
How does that, do you know how that compares to a white-tailed deer?
It's less, but I don't know. I can't remember exactly what white-tailed deer.
How does it compare? Well, a deer runs into your vehicle. And a goose flies into your vehicle.
Yeah. I think a lot of the goose collisions are from people breaking and then getting rear-ended. And also they, you know, being a 10-pound bird, they'll do a lot of damage. So those are the sort of the main pieces of rationale for that overabundance was the size of the population. They're more than double the management goal that we set out back in my predecessor set out in 2000. They're growing at a really fast rate. The ability of hunting in the fall, we've basically maxed out everything we can do. We've, you know, increased our bag limits. We've gotten rid of, we changed possession limits. There's been all sorts of hunter recruitment initiatives. We can't really do anything else in the fall because of the swamping effect of those other populations. And they're causing all this other damage, plus all the aesthetic issues of, you know, geese and golf courses and public spaces. And
yeah.
I think it's really well recognized that there's too many geese, too many canada geese.
It's interesting that, you know, that's the issue that you guys are dealing with, which is kind of the opposite of what most other conservation people that are dealing with like lots of the big game animals. You're dealing with a reduction in how do we keep these animals, you know,
yeah, but
populated.
At the same time, another thing that's interesting is what Chase just said, but you got to add in the fact that, in my opinion, people keep growing, like the goose populations and stuff, basically they're breeding the way they do it is kind of staying the same, but we're taking up more and more territory. There's more, less and less hunters out there. There's more and more, you know what I mean? Like different crops and so on and so forth. And then when it comes to Manitoba with deer populations and everything else, there's more and more bush getting pushed for agricultural reasons. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that pertains to the populations growing, but yeah, when it comes to geese, they have this number that, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, that kind of stays at a steady number, and it's just everything around them is evolving and changing that it's hard to keep that number level, right?
Part of the issue with geese, too, for conservation, so there's all sorts of habitat issues out there with ducks and people, you know, draining wetlands and the productivity of wetlands, but one of the things that we keep facing with geese is that they do cause so much spring crop damage. Most of that crop damage is occurring in the springtime, and it's on a virgin canola and soybeans, that we're sort of losing conservation support for waterfowl and wetland management and retention. So most of the productive wetlands occur in Western Manitoba, and most of them are on private land. And we keep hearing about the sort of disinterest to people to retain potholes if it is going to mean that there's going to be more Canada geese around to eat their emerging soybeans and canola. So,
right.
So we think that trying to bring Canada geese under control will be, you know, beneficial in the future management of wetland habitat and so that some of the duck populations that use those habitats. So
that's going to be a crazy argument though, because you've got for instance, Manitoba, a lot of its economy and everything revolves around agriculture, right? So these guys want more and more land to produce more and more, which is obvious. But at the same time, you kind of want to conserve land for the waterfowl. So at the same time, you're still trying to find that number that's going to work for everyone. That's going to be the hardest thing in the world.
Yeah, that's a real issue, I think. But there's some new ideas on how we can kind of make these landscapes mutually beneficial. So there's some emerging programs where conservation organizations sort of pay for some of the wetland to be retained for its ecological goods and services. So the farmer gets compensated to not turn that wetland
right.
into something you could plant a crop in, and that payment sort of recognizes the service that it's providing to the sort of the greater, you know.
Yeah, but there's got to be a little bit of 50-50 on that as well, because I've heard the same argument with shelter belts and stuff. They kind of have that same kind of program. But then wouldn't that, at the end of the day, make your land less valuable to the price of someone wanting to buy it for agriculture reasons? So if you got 80 acres with four sloughs on it, but then you go to buy it and they're like, oh, there's 80 acres of land. You go to buy it and then all of a sudden it's like, well, no, there's only actually 60 acres because, you know, the other 20 are sloughs or ponds or whatever.
Right, if there's an easement on it that says that they can't do anything about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that a yearly compensation kind of paid to the farmers, or is that like a one-time thing?
There's a few different programs out there. Some of the easements are one-times with a window, like a certain amount of time on them. And then there's other ones that are... There's other programs that are modeled to be sort of more annual payments. So, there's a bunch of different organizations working on that in Manitoba. Ducks Unlimited's working on it, Delta Waterfowl. And then there's a new program model on this alternative land use services. So I'm less familiar with that sort of side of the of management, but there's a lot of good people working on that, trying to figure out a nice balance.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a real challenge.
Oh, for sure. Sure.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago talking to my uncle who owned some farmland, and he had a kind of a significant portion of his farm was wetland, and we had been on some really good waterfowl hunts in that particular wetland, but he was talking, you know, I think there was some sort of government funding to turn the wetland back into farmland, and then a couple of years later you hear the programs about turning some farmland back into wetlands and stuff like that. So it's kind of like a juggling act there, thinking, all right, what's this money really doing here? Like, are you guys going to figure this out, or what's happening?
I've heard the same thing with the shelter belt programs through time. Yeah
So besides the spring goose season, Is there anything else that you have kind of on your plate in the radar right now for on the conservation side of things, or is there what else are you working on?
For the waterfowl stuff, the spring goose work's consuming a lot of my time. But we've also been rewriting a few management plans on our flyway, ones for snow geese and other ones for this merger of Canada goose populations, some of the other Arctic goose populations also. And making sure that our monitoring is really strong by the time this comes through, so we have a really good understanding of how this affects those populations. We're also doing some work trying to band diving ducks. So we're trying to capture and band canvasbacks and redheads, and look at harvest rates on them. And we've got some preliminary results from the last 2 years that suggest that the harvest rates on, well, we've mostly been catching redheads, but they're extremely high. And we're sort of in a unique position where the redheads from Manitoba and likely the canvasbacks also get shot in three different flyways. And they're quite vulnerable to being, we have a very poor understanding about how, about whether that harvest is sustainable. Most of it's coming out of the U.S. and we shoot a very small portion of them.
I can tell you any canvasbacks of that hunt has been a very sustainable hunt. Yes, I remember hunting in the inner lake there on, I can't remember what water body it was, but I went out with a buddy and we were hunting. I think it was mostly canvasbacks and redheads coming through. And of course I was shooting hypersonic through a pump shotgun and just destroyed my, the finger sitting behind the trigger guard, and, did not come home with a lot of birds. That's for sure. But it was a blast. I think that just the massive bird flying through there at such high speed really throws you off.
And yeah.
I think I was shooting behind a lot of them, even with that hypersonic.
I think shooting that hypersonic, it's pretty easy to be scared of, to flinch.
I was busted up by the end of the day, man.
Yeah.
I'll tell you.
We talked about those, or you've mentioned the flyways. For anyone else listening, do you want to go through? There's four of them that generally, I guess there's only four for North America.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of general guidelines too. There's the Atlantic, so moving east to west. There's the Atlantic, the Mississippi, the Central, and then the Pacific.
And we're under the Mississippi.
We're in the Mississippi, but we do share. We do have. So we, I'm the Manitoba's rep on the Mississippi Flyway Council technical section.
Okay.
And we do have some birds, obviously, from Manitoba that go through the Central Flyway. Some more giants from Western Manitoba, and we'll see it shot in the Dakotas, and that's in the Central Flyway, and down through Kansas and that too. But predominantly, our birds go through the Mississippi Flyway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Got to ask you. A few years ago, you introduced was it sniper or woodcock season?
Woodcock.
Woodcock. So what was the reason behind that? Like, I mean, I grew up, I never even heard or thought about shooting woodcocks. Talk just for a brief moment about that.
Sure. So woodcock are a sort of a forest-dwelling shorebird, really. Similar in appearance, but quite a bit larger than a snipe, than a Wilson snipe, which you see in sort of the wetland margins. They like similar habitat to rough grouse. You kind of find them on the edges, except they're migratory. They go down, our birds go down to, well, they follow mostly the Mississippi Flyway, go down as far as, you know, Arkansas. And they are well monitored. We've had a survey since about 1992, different routes around the province where we go out right at dusk, about half hour after sunset, and the males are performing a flight to attract females. And
is that the kind of call? Is that right?
It's kind of a peat. It's like a bzzzt.
Oh, okay. Bzzzt. Totally missed it.
You probably wouldn't actually associate it with being a bird.
I think I know what you're talking about, yeah.
But you'll hear them, like, yeah, there's in the Interlake and especially Eastern Manitoba, that's where most of them are, but they bzzzt, they kind of buzz, and they're pretty neat. And we do have some routes that have some of the highest densities in our kind of management unit, so
cool.
Sharing with the U.S. And there's not many people probably knew what they are, but there's a bunch of people out there that run like pointing dogs and are big sort of rough grouse hunters. That's their thing. You know, our things like maybe hunting ducks, but their thing is hunting grouse, and they've been asking for a woodcock season for years. And with the data that we had, there's absolutely no reason why there shouldn't have been a season. So we had this great monitoring data set, a survey that was continuing, the ability to have a harvest survey, and these birds are already getting shot all through the U.S. jurisdictions that they migrate. So there's really
right.
no reason not to have a season. So we implemented them.
That's cool. That's definitely a right step, or a step in the right direction for Manitoba for migratory game birds, and obviously the grouse hunters are happy about that.
Yeah, I'm not much of a grouse hunter myself. I've gotten a little bit more into it, and I've been a few times chasing woodcock, and dogs love them. Yeah, my dog's has not done a lot of upland bird hunting, but they must be pretty stinky, because she can find them, and they're really fun to hunt, and good to eat too.
Yeah, you're done. Sweet. You got anything else on the docket there, Sheldon?
I could talk all day here. No, about the dark key stuff and the flyways, and I don't know. I think we kind of hit everything I want to talk about on that subject.
Yeah, I think we have. I mean, with Frank here, definitely an opportunity if you want to come back another day and dive into some upland game stuff. If you're keen for that.
Wild turkeys would be another one.
Turkeys, we talked about doing that as well. But
yeah.
There's so much. You can only get so much time. And
yeah.
Time,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So much subject. So if you're not hunting waterfowl, what are you going to hunt next? What's your next big hunt other than waterfowl?
Well, I'll just tell you. So I'll be after spring snow geese right away here in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I'll actually be up north in the park. The park is... Well, Pusk National Park's organizing a community snow goose hunt, first time ever. In the national park.
Yeah.
So that's happening out of Nestorwan, so I'll be there for that. And then I'll be chasing Spring Barrier, the bull. That's next.
Right on.
And yeah.
You do that all yourself, Spring Bear?
Yeah.
You bait and all that?
Yeah.
Right on. And what's your dream hunt?
Ooh,
coming up.
That's a good one. I'm looking forward to archery elk. I did rifle elk last fall, and had some a lot of fun trading some bugles with some nice bulls, and I'm looking forward to archery elk.
Yeah, we're doing archery elk again this year, and we're gonna try.
Yeah, last year was our first year doing it, and it was definitely pretty exciting.
Yeah,
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 yeah. So hopefully this year will be a little more successful, but. As in putting an animal on the ground, not to say that last year wasn't a success, but
yeah,
it's a cool hunt.
Yeah.
Well, Frank, how about, do you have any last words of wisdom before we wrap it up here in the direction for conservation, or to, you know, just to, motivate some hunters and stuff to get a little more involved in conservation?
Yeah, I think it's, first of all, I'd like to say that hunters are, especially in the waterfowl management side of things, hunters are really integral to waterfowl management. So report your bands. We don't just use banding data to look at where birds go. That's sort of the last thing that we use it for. We really use it for looking at harvest rates and survival rates and monitoring status of those populations. And so definitely report your bands. And yeah, just know that through your harvest surveys and through your reporting of bands, you're really involved in the management process. It's sort of a unique system where the hunter is right sort of involved in the collection of the data. So definitely for waterfowl, banding data is the most important information that we have in our toolbox. And if we don't have hunters on the ground, then we don't know half as much as we do about these populations. So
right.
Just quickly on bands before we take off, is what do you get, like a ballpark number, like what number of bands do you band a year? Like how many birds are you banding a year?
We band about a little over 2,000 giant Canada geese, and then about 3,500 subarctic Canada geese, and a few thousand ducks per year.
Okay.
And then Canadian Wildlife Service does a large number of ducks, and then they also band most of the snow geese and most of the cackling geese in the Arctic. I think they do probably around more than 20,000 Arctic nesting geese. So, yeah.
That's a big number.
Yeah.
So I think that all plays into like reporting your bands and stuff like that is, as hunters, I think we have a bit of a responsibility to report bands. Another big one, which, I mean, I've been guilty of myself of not doing them in the past, but now they've been, I've become more prudent to do them, is the surveys that come across through mail or online, through email, whatever. And hunters can really speak their voice through that too, and can report back to conservation what they're seeing and what they're harvesting and stuff like that. And that's, I think that's crucial for conservation tactics too.
Yeah. So. And the other thing too is, like, when it comes to bands, I think for myself, anybody that's like starting out hunting, waterfowl hunting or whatever, you get a bird with a band usually on its foot, ankle area, and you take it off and you report it, and then you can actually find out the information of the bird. So where it's banded, you know, and it's kind of cool, like, because sometimes they're banded way up north and you're shooting them in Franklin, Manitoba, and you're like, oh my God, he went this far. And as a first-time bird hunter or getting new into the sport, you can kind of realize where they're flying from, the projects Manitoba has to sustain a good population and all this stuff. It's a good thing to report your bands, right? Because you kind of get a little bit more information than just knowing how to cook them and eat them.
Absolutely. And it's all, now it's pretty much instantaneous. When you report your band, you get the details back on how old the bird was, where it was banded, all that information. It's done electronically now through reportband.gov, and yeah, you get all your details.
Are some agencies giving out certificates too, like with information on
that's
band
how,
that you've harvested?
That's how they do it.
Yeah, every bird you report, you'll get a certificate for.
That's
and
cool.
If there's, you know, if you shoot a bird and you don't know who, you know, you're with a group of other of folks and you don't know who shot it, you can get a certificate for everybody in the group. And
oh, cool.
Yeah.
And then with the reward bands, what's the point of that?
The reward bands are put on to try and figure out the proportion of people that actually report banded birds. So what they did is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and then Canadian Wildlife Service, they put out different bands of different denominations. So they had $20, $50, $100, $200, $500 U.S. And then they looked at the difference in the proportion that were shot of those different denominations, and they looked for sort of where the proportion plateaued, and that was what they assumed was 100% reporting rate. And so it was just like a system to, like, a sort of an encouragement system, and like, how many dollars does it take for everybody to report their this reward band, and then what are regular bands at the same time. There's a control what are regular bands reported at. And that's when they figured out that about 74% of people in Canada report their bands.
And the other 30% are just going on the lanyards pretty much.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And there's all sorts of things that influence whether you report your band, like whether the bird was banded sort of in like where the bird might have come from. So there's sort of like band reporting fatigue where people, if they're hunting like and they know there's kind of a banding site around, they're shooting birds and they realize that every bird they shoot likely came from that same spot, so they're no longer interested. And we wonder if the same thing isn't happening with some of the birds that we banned in Winnipeg here that have those riveted on bands where people shoot one of those and then they know, oh, this is a bird from Winnipeg. And so it's about 74%. So that was the purpose, is to figure out that harvest rate, the proportion of population that you kill, you need to figure out what the reporting rate is to correct it, right?
Right. And what about guys that are like, say, going out shit hunting this time of year or whatever, and they come across a dead bird in the slough or what have you with a band on it? Are you guys wanting them reported as well?
Yeah, they just get, so when they report it, there's a whole drop down menu how did you come across it? Did you shoot it? Did you find it? So you just fill all that information in, and then it goes into one massive repository. And then when we pull it to analyze it, we'll, for the harvest rate data, we just pull birds that are shot. We don't pull the birds that are reported in any other way, like found, or sometimes people take pictures and reobserve live, you know, bands on live birds. And so, it all gets sort of, how it enters the database sort of depends on how you find it.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
It's good to know.
Right on. Well, I think that's
closing. Do you have any closing remarks, Chase?
No. I think I pretty much wrapped up my closing remarks with the surveys and the banding and stuff like that. And oh, there goes my book. So that must be
it.
Yeah. How about yourself, Sheldon?
No, I just thanks a lot, Frank, for coming out. It was a great time, just flew by, and it's good to have guys like you on, and hopefully we'll be able to do it again soon.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to come back.
Right on.
Right on. It's been fantastic. And thanks again. And everybody out there, thanks for listening. And give us your feedback on what you thought of today. And if you have any more questions for Frank, we can certainly send them his way if you want to. Yeah. Drop us a line, or if you have any questions
mail
for us.
Just pull and after this airs,
panoramicoutdoors@gmail.com, or look us up on social media, Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah, check us out on YouTube.
Thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you in the next episode.